This is Fresh Air. After writing about gay life in contemporary America, David Levitt has looked to the past for his new novel, While England Sleeps. Levitt is the author of The Lost Language of Cranes and Equal Affections. His first collection of stories, Family Dancing, was published when he was 23 and was nominated for the Penn Faulkner Award and National Book Critics Circle Award. His new novel is about love and betrayal, art and politics, and is set in Europe in the 1930s. An upper-class young writer named Brian falls in love with a ticket taker in the London Underground named Edward. When Brian has an affair with a woman, Edward, heartbroken, runs away to join the Loyalists in the Spanish Civil War. Levitt says his book is inspired in part by the British poet Stephen Spender's memoir. Spender has actually sued Levitt in England for breaching copyright and for breaking a British law that protects authors from having their work altered. Levitt declined to comment on the suit. I told him I was surprised that he set his novel during the Spanish Civil War. In the past, he'd been criticized by some for not writing about larger political and social issues and for being too insular and suburban. Is his new novel a response to those criticisms?
You know, I would like to think not. I would like to think that I don't choose to write about anything in response to criticisms. Who can know, ultimately? I do know that I reached a point where it seemed to me impossible to continue as a writer without contending on some level with politics. And I was thinking initially of trying to write about the politics of the 80s, the politics of the world I was living in at the time I began this novel, as well as the time I finished the novel. And the reason that I was drawn to the Spanish Civil War and to that period was because I saw so many parallels between the 30s and the 80s. And it seemed to me to provide an opportunity, as it were, to write about what I would call the AIDS wars without writing about them, to create a kind of historical allegory for the period we're living in now.
What were the parallels that you saw?
Well, primarily the fact that specifically in this novel, this is the story of one man trying to save another man's life, one gay man trying to save his lover's life. And certainly the period we live in now is full of stories like that. It's also about the clash between a feeling of loyalty to a cause or a country on the one hand, and a sense of deserving a degree of personal fulfillment which that cause or country or institution deems immoral or deems wrong on some level. Forster wrote in his essay, What I Believe, he said, if I had to choose between betraying my country and betraying my friend, I should hope I should have the guts to betray my country. And really, I think the dilemma that this novel presents is the dilemma of a gay man for whom that choice isn't merely hypothetical. It's very, very literal. It's very visceral. And I think now, as well, gay men are constantly finding themselves in a position of having to make a similar choice.
You wrote your new novel, While England Sleeps, during the debate on gays in the military. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if writing about the Spanish Civil War, writing about the military back in the 30s, affected your take on the gays in the military debate, or if, in fact, the debate affected the issues that you put in your book.
It did and it didn't. It's a peculiar parallel because, in this case, what the novel's about is someone trying to get out of the military, whereas the debate about gays in the military is about the rights of gay people to be in the military. One parallel that I do see and that I thought about a lot while I was writing the book was the fact that there is a real disparity in people's attitudes toward, on the one hand, gay behavior, that is, sex between members of the same sex, and on the other hand, homosexual identity. There's a curious paradox there, and it's a paradox that's always existed both here and in England. The problem in the military never seemed to be the fact that gay men and lesbians in the military were having sex with each other or with members of the same sex. That's been going on forever, and I think it's always been implicitly accepted as long as it wasn't talked about. The crisis began when gay men and lesbians in the military demanded that their identity be acknowledged and accepted. And that curious distinction between behavior and identity is one that all gay men and lesbians have to deal with, and it's an interesting conflict. It's also one that comes up in the novel, particularly in the scenes where Brian is trying to convince John Northrop, the head of the English Brigade, to let Edward go. And it becomes clearer and clearer that Northrop's conception of their relationship is that of a sort of sexual exploitation. That is, the upper-class man exploiting the lower-class man. He can't conceive of the relationship as one that has emotional or that has an emotional basis or that is based on love. He assumes that it's purely about sex. I think a lot of people assume that gay relationships are purely about sex because they're unable to make the cognitive leap from the idea of homosexual behavior to the idea of homosexual identity. And that, to me, is a theme that I've been dealing with in my work since the very beginning. I am always asking the question, to what extent does what we do determine who we are?
My guest is David Levitt, author of the new novel, While England Sleeps. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Novelist David Levitt is my guest. Do you think of yourself as being active in the gay rights movement? I remember in an article from several years ago, you were talking about how when you were younger and you needed a job, you went to a gay bookstore, you know, and asked about work. And the owner of the store was asking you about your movement experience.
My movement experience.
Yeah, and you thought that they were referring to dance.
Yeah.
Which shows the amount of, you know, gay rights movement experience you had at that time. Did that change?
To some extent, there was a period when I was very, very involved with ACT UP, but that wasn't so much gay rights as ACT UP at that point, especially, was really focused on AIDS. And that was, I think, what made it such a wonderful organization. Since then, I've been living abroad a lot, so I haven't had the opportunity to be involved. But I think that when you're a writer who writes openly about the experience of gay people, and when you yourself are open about being gay, necessarily you have to contend with the fact that what you're doing is political and has political implications.
Since you hadn't joined large groups before or movements before, why did you decide to join ACT UP a few years ago?
Well, it seemed impossible not to join. The situation then, as now, was so bad. There was such a clear deadlock in the government. We had Bush in the White House. We had Edward Koch as mayor of New York. We had an FDA that was not only unresponsive but completely bogged down in its own bureaucracy. And all around me in New York, people were dying. And it seemed to me, as I think it seemed to a lot of people at that point in the late 80s, that there was no alternative. Something had to be done. And ACT UP seemed incredibly exciting because its tactics were so new and they were actually so effective. A few years later, like everything, the tactics ceased to be new. They ceased to be quite so effective. I think a lot of people burnt out. I think they burnt out because, first of all, of internal battling. I remember ACT UP San Francisco ended up dividing into two different chapters based on an ideological debate within the organization. I think people also started burning out because they had the sense that for every three steps forward that you took, you were four steps back. It was a sort of endless uphill battle, and it didn't seem that we were winning. And there was a point when I think even Larry Kramer started really burning out. And I came to the conclusion, as I think a lot of people did, that perhaps ACT UP's time or its moment of glory had passed, and it was necessary to find other ways to combat the epidemic. I also had to make a personal choice to move because I was finding that I couldn't write in New York and I needed to be somewhere else. And it was at that point that I went to Spain.
Why did you go that far?
I needed to go someplace where I could hear myself think, and in New York, it was impossible for me to hear myself think. There was too much of what I call cultural noise going on. I had an invitation to go to Spain as a visiting foreign writer at a literary institute that was really a kind of arm of the Department of Culture of the Catalan government, and it seemed like too good an opportunity to pass up.
Even though you're not living in the States, you're still officially a member of the PEN, Gay and Lesbian Committee. PEN is the organization, the international organization of writers. Censorship is a big issue for the committee. Has your work ever been censored? Have you ever had a problem with that?
Just this week, I discovered that the Canadian Customs appropriated two boxes of a place I've never been, my most recent book of short stories, as part of a kind of continuing campaign to keep books with gay subject matter from getting into Canada. It's a real problem, and it's something which Penn is working very hard on.
So are you planning on taking any further action?
There's not really much action I can take except to complain loudly, and I'll certainly do that.
Now, what about in England? What's the law there about not being able to...
Clause 28.
Yeah.
Yeah, it prohibits works of art that are seen as promoting a homosexual lifestyle. England is a very odd example because the party line has so little to do with the way people actually live and think. And Clause 28 was really scary when it was introduced and when it was put into law. I think people were very worried. It's almost entirely unenforced at this point. I think the Parliament, having agreed to Clause 28, is really scared to try to use it because I think they realize that it would cause such a huge uproar. And writers have been writers, filmmakers, artists have been challenging it at every opportunity, and the government has made no effort that I'm aware of to actually enforce it.
You had a TV production of your novel, The Lost Language of Cranes. It was a joint production, I think, by PBS and the BBC.
Right.
And there was some controversy about the embrace between two males that was shown. How did you handle that? Did you try to keep out of it or what?
I thought it was a little bit overblown. There were some editing differences between the American and the English version, primarily having to do with nudity. Some scenes in the English version where the protagonists are naked were reshot for the American version with the protagonists wearing boxer shorts. Well, it seems sort of stupid for two characters to get out of bed after having made love and both be in their underwear, but I didn't think it was worth the sort of protest that a lot of people made about it, especially since what was to me the most important scene, which was the initial kiss between the characters, was preserved intact. So, you know, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but I thought it was much too much of a fuss over a fairly minor issue. The fact that Texaco withdrew its backing of Great Performances exactly at the time the Great Performances was airing both The Lost Language of Cranes and Portrait of a Marriage, I think was something much more worth yelling and screaming about.
So you're living in Italy writing a new novel now.
Yeah, I am.
What's the new novel about?
Well, it's not a novel that loans itself easily to description, and it's very much in its earliest moments. But it is pursuing a theme that has been a very important theme to me over the years, and that is, as I said earlier, the relationship between what we do and who we are.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I'm trying to talk about questions of identity in terms of gender. That is, you know, what makes a man, what makes a woman, and also what makes a writer, and to what extent does the fact that as writers we are constantly appropriating the lives of people we know and turning them into fiction, what moral consequences does that action have? These are some of the things that the novel's going to explore.
Well, David, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
David Levitt's new novel is called While England Sleeps. This is Fresh Air.